I'm Christopher Lydon, trying on a new moral map of the Middle East with the Iranian scholar of movies, music, religion, and politics, Hamid Dabashi at Columbia University. He will tell you that an old Iranian fable is playing itself out. It's a story about a wily fox, a tired old lion, and a hapless donkey. This is open source from the Watson Institute at Brown University. An American conversation with global attitude, we call it. Professor Dabashi, we're always trying to honor Robert Burns' advice to see ourselves as others see us. But especially after Egypt, Tahrir Square, the flight of our guy, Hosni Mubarak, even now in the Libyan civil war, there is an unfed American hunger, I think, to know where the imperial U.S. has been, where it's going, in what feels like a new creation.
Well, the world after Tahrir Square is a new world that is giving birth to itself, and we are not yet sure what precisely are its components and contours and characteristics. I have an Egyptian friend, colleague, who teaches at UC Davis and dropped everything and went to Tahrir Square when the event happened. Recently, she came back. We were having dinner and says to me, "Why are you so excited? We always knew about these events. They will happen. Mm. Why are you so excited about these events in North Africa and so forth?" My answer is, yes, we knew cerebrally, we knew theoretically, we knew narratively. We actually never saw. Tahrir Square is the ground zero. And I said this almost 2 years earlier about Meydan Azadi, which is the functional equivalent of Tahrir Square in Tehran, of a seismic change. A seismic change that is informed not by miracles, not by ideologies, but by demography and by economics. Mm. 80% of the population of Iran is under the age of 40, 70% under the age of 35, 50% under the age of 50, which is precisely the demographic composition of the Arab and Islamic world from Morocco to Iran, from Bahrain to Yemen. Mm-hmm. That demography is a key factor. They are wired. Now, that doesn't mean this is a Twitter or a Facebook revolution. What Twitter and Facebook have done, they have extended the public space. They have not replaced the public space. It's still Tahrir Square, still Meydan Azadi is where the action is. In addition to demography is economics. Neoliberal economics ain't working.
Would you just extend your sense of the new beginning in two other directions? You speak of demography and economics. What about culture and what about identity?
First of all, I insist on demography and economics because I want people to realize that this is not just wishful thinking. This is deeply grass-rooted. This is rooted in a youthful imagination, in a youthful desire. And it is materially based because it is predicated on economic necessities. When you have young students in Great Britain burning down a building that wants to raise their tuition, you're facing with a phenomenon. That's number one. But identity and culture both predicates these uprisings and will follow from it at the same time. Identity and culture in the sense that no longer is this entrapment of the West as an idea or the East as a counterpart idea or Muslims and such is limiting you in terms of your global planetary imagination. For the first time, we are coming to terms with two factors. Environment and labor migration are key factors that will change the identity and cultural aspects. 300 million laborers are roaming around the globe in search of job, statistically, according to UN. This is the size of the United States. These two factors, environment, labor migration, are also at work when it comes to reimagining the planet, reimagining this fragile little home, this ship on which we live. These are the two factors that will decide the identity and culture.
Here's my other little piece of what's new, and it involves us. We think of ourselves as an anti-imperial, anti-colonial nation, at least in our DNA, and we're shocked to wake up and realize that we not only inherited the map that followed World War I and World War II, but we're playing the same old British roles in Iraq and in Egypt and the French in Syria and in Lebanon to some degrees, that map has persisted until Tahrir Square. And suddenly we're forced to realize, wait a sec, we are the enforcers of the old colonial and imperial relationships even. What is the change there, and how does it involve us Americans?
There are a number of ways that some historians have tried to come to terms. What exactly is the nature of American imperialism? Niall Ferguson calls Americans closet imperialists.
Right. And urges, wants us out.
Yeah, exactly. He says, come out and flaunt it. Fantastic. The whole world is run by imperialism. To which my answer in one essay was, empires don't last. If empires lasted, everybody spoke Persian these days. The irony, fantastic irony of history, is that you don't need the brown man to kick Niall Ferguson's ass. Fantastic student uprising in UK are kicking Niall Ferguson's butt by virtue of the fact that this system is not working. And you're imposing limitations on education with this cockamamie imperial attitude. But let's go back to America, because that to me is more crucial by virtue of our size, by virtue of our imagination. So one theory is that the United States is a closet thing. The second is a reluctant giant. My sense is that there is a fundamental contradiction, repression of the Boston Tea Party, repression of the fact that this society, this culture, in fact, emerged as an anti-colonial. The first major historical anti-colonial uprising was the American Revolution against British imperialism. But what is happening today is that the globe, I mean, if you look at the level and volume of immigration into the United States. Mm. United States is also coming to terms with the fact that it is a microcosm of the world. My generation, I came to U.S. 1976, is not just in the cuisine that people didn't know how to... there was no yogurt. Do you know that in 1976, people had no freaking clue what's feta cheese or what's pita bread or what's...
Or shallots.
Nothing. I mean, there was
Julia Child helped.
In Philadelphia. No, Julia Child had absolutely nothing to do with it. Labor migration had everything to do with it. In Philadelphia, in South Philly, I mean, I'm from Philly. That's where I went to school. There was one Lebanese... I mean, I was there recently, and this is still... Well, there was one Lebanese joint that had pita bread and feta cheese. But right now, look, is common a staple. I have another fantastic story to tell you. When my eldest son, Kaveh, used to go to a kindergarten in Philadelphia, one day, the mother of one of his classmates, Christian, comes and tells me, you know, Christian was telling me today, Kaveh's father has a strange name. What is this name of Kaveh's father, Hamid? What kind of a name is that? So Christian's mother says, well, Hamid is a name, is an Iranian name, but what about Kaveh? And Christian tells to his mother in 1980, he says, no, Kaveh is a regular American name. Because he's his friend, he's his classmate. He doesn't have any idea of what is the difference between Kevin and Kaveh. Mm. It says all sounds the same to him. The world came to the United States. The United States didn't go to the world by virtue of this exceptionalism and so forth. The world historically and demographically came to the world. We are ready to be part of the globe. My hope and aspiration was that after the horrid events of 9/11, mm-hmm. United States will go back to the fold of the world and realize what it means for innocent people to be murdered, for buildings to crumble. But because of the power of the neocon ideology, they managed to keep this exceptionalism through this cockamamie war on terror and not to allow United mm-hmm. States to go where it belongs, to the fold of the world, because the world is already here. I'm a living example of the mm-hmm. fact that in the heart of American culture, there is receptivity for alterities in various cultures. I have been who I am. I have been welcomed, my family, my children. I have not named my children John, Jack, and Jane. They have old, beautiful Persian names. And I always thought a culture and a country that can pronounce Zbigniew Brzezinski and can pronounce anything. So we are no longer at the mercy of the propaganda machinery of a state. Look at the miracle of WikiLeaks. I mean, think that historically, theoretically, it was supposed to be a case that the life of individual citizens are private and the operation of a state is open, transparent. But through history, the operation of a state has become secretive and our lives have become open books to surveillances. The WikiLeaks has reversed that order. Now we are privy to eavesdropping. How is it that these diplomats speak to each other? So there is, through technology, there is a equilibrium in terms of people's power. So I'm very optimistic that people resonate with Egypt. People see through the hypocrisy. People see through the double standard of, on one side, Americans and British are selling arms to Gaddafi over the last decade and so, and then suddenly Gaddafi becomes enemy number one.
Question is, how in our own heads do we deal with this kind of exposure of our colonial relationship with the world? And how do we slowly dismantle it, not just in the relationships, the diplomatic and military and economic relationships, but in our minds?
Listen, in our mind will happen predicated on the fact that in the aftermath of the Iraq and Afghanistan operation, the fact of the matter, and also the Israeli operation, both in 2006 in Lebanon and 2008-2009 in Gaza, that conventional army power means nothing. That this is the age of asymmetrical warfare to begin with. That is, if you look at the situation prior to the rise of the Green Movement in Iran, you had a balance of power between United States and its regional and European allies on one side, and Islamic Republic and three of its subnational allies on the other. And the best metaphor is American football. Islamic Republic was like a quarterback with three wide receivers, Hezbollah, Hamas, and Mahdi's army. And they had checkmated United States and Israel. United States and Israel could not do anything against Islamic Republic. If they invaded Iran, they would have strengthened it. If they sat down to negotiate with it, they would have strengthened it. So Americans are forced to come to terms with the globality of their condition and the worldly presence that they have, that they no longer can kick people around, as the neocons thought, by virtue of the transformation of nature of military encounter in the world, that no longer conventional army can do anything. For 32 days, Israel pounded from land, from air, from sea, Lebanon. They left in defeat, and Hezbollah was more powerful than it was before the Israelis came in 2006.
You have a fascinating take on Iran, which, in your view, is getting stronger in the world all the time, even as it's getting more divided, more weak, more sick at home. Explain that. And maybe you ought to go from there to the fable of the fox, the lion, the donkey.
Yeah. I began my book with the fable because I was just so tired of this silly carrot and stick metaphor that I thought doesn't work. The fable, which is one of many other fantastic stories, is the story of this lion, powerful, omnipotent, the king, majesty, just sitting there and doing whatever he wants, but he gets old. And there was this fox who used to benefit from the leftover or whatever prey the lion had chanced upon. And the king, the lion confides to the fox that, you know, I have this disease. I can't hunt anymore. And they have told me, my physicians, my royal physicians have told me that I need to have the ears and the brain of a donkey, of a mule. So the fox says, why didn't you say so, Your Majesty? I'm at your service. There's a donkey. I'll be happy to bring him over for Your Majesty. So the donkey's fooled, comes to the lion. The lion attacks him, but he's too weak, and the donkey runs away. So the fox goes to the lion and says, what happened, Your Majesty? I brought him all over here, and you couldn't do the hunting. He says, well, what can I tell you? I'm weak. Go bring him back. And so how can I bring him back again? Well, so I don't know. You're the fox. At any rate, he fools the donkey, brings him back. The lion attacks, kills the donkey, and wants to feast on his brain and his ears. But he says, first I have to do my ablutions, because my physicians have told me I have to do my ablutions before I eat this, so it has an effect on my ailment. He goes to do his ablutions. The fox gobbles up the ears and the brain and so forth. The king comes back and says, so what happened to this donkey's ear and brain? And the fox says, if this donkey had ears, which is an organ of perception, and a brain, which is a faculty of reasoning, would he have come back for a second time after I did what we did to him the first time? So I use that metaphor. Aging king, aging lion is United States, doesn't have the wherewithal that it used to have. And fox is Iran, and donkey is this thing called the Middle East. What a ghastly term, Middle East. And the maneuver, the way that Iran Islamic Republic has managed to maneuver, manipulating crisis after crisis over the last 30 years, because internally it has no legitimacy, externally has managed to stay in power, not just by virtue of how wily it has acted, but also by the stupidity of one administration after another administration, from Reagan to Bush, creating mess in the region that then Islamic Republic becomes the beneficiary. But this was my analysis up until the Tahrir Square. After the Tahrir Square, with the same token that United States and Israel are using their friends in the region, something even worse is happening to Islamic Republic. Islamic Republic is losing its enemies. And in that region, losing enemies is worse than losing friends.
What's the enemy Iran has lost?
Egypt, Tunisia, Saudi Arabia, they're all in trouble. These are the enemies. I mean, the word enemy is the most repeated word, not only for Bush. You remember, Bush every time wanted to talk, the enemy is coming, the enemy is yellow, down, the enemy is red. But in Islamic Republic, this is straight out of the fascist theory of Carl Schmitt. You need an enemy in order to create political prowess. All the geopolitics of the region that was conducive to Islamic Republic becoming the beneficiary of those conditions is changing. It's changing by the rise in the democratic will of people from Morocco to Syria. So it is not just Syria, the ally of the Islamic Republic, that is now in deep, deep trouble. But Saudi Arabia, Egypt, they're all in trouble. And so the geopolitics is changing. That cozy arrangement that the Islamic Republic had as a quarterback with three wide receivers, that game is over by virtue of the rise of the democratic will that is engulfing Islamic Republic itself. And there is a tacit, occasionally explicit, solidarity between the Green Movement activists and events in Egypt.
The Democrats in Iran and the Democrats in Egypt, you say?
Yeah.
Two questions. We haven't seen who the rising power is or what it looks like, who the new leader of a new Egypt is going to be. Secondly, it's part of certainly the conventional discourse is that what happened in Iran is a real danger to these emerging proto-democracies in the Arab world.
Yeah. You know, you remind me, I was being interviewed by a Danish reporter when the Green Movement in Iran had started. And he asked me, but there is no charismatic leader for this Green Movement. Don't you think we need a charismatic leader? I said, no. We're done with charismatic leaders. I said, do I know who is the president of Denmark? I have no idea. We want a president. We don't even know, remember his name and his shape and his face. We're done. In fact, it is the miracle of these democratic uprisings that are not centered around a charismatic figure, that are not centered around a political party, that are not centered around a specific ideological. This is the rise of a vox populi. For the first time, the voice of the people is emerging, and it is open-ended. Now, before you accuse me of being delusional and idealistic, etc., it doesn't mean that this will not form into political organization. Now, everybody is afraid that the Muslim Brotherhood will take over, that they are organized, they are systematic, etc. But look at the young kids in Tahrir Square singing and dancing, this carnivalesque occasion that is emerging from one end of the world to another. They will do it. That is this fundamental distrust of grand narratives, whether it is Islamic grand narrative or Marxist grand narrative or whatever. Distrust of these grand illusions that they will resolve, that will systematically, gradually create alternative worlds. It is not just the world that is being refashioned and renumbered. Third world, where is third world? Who said there is one part of the world, first and the second world? Those old vocabularies are changing, as well as the very DNA of our political thinking. We don't know precisely what the nature of this emerging political culture is, but boy, is it good to be alive and witness it.
But isn't that precisely what Iran thought it had in 1979, an anonymous, broad-based democratic revolution without superstars? That sort of thing can go terribly wrong.
It can, but everything can go terribly wrong. But in 1977-79 revolution, it was a classic 19th-20th century revolution, like French Revolution, like Russian Revolution, like European revolutions of 1848, with a centralized charismatic figure called Ayatollah Khomeini, who picked up the phone from Neuf Le Chateau, made a phone call, and people were out in the streets doing precisely as he asked. No, we no longer have. In fact, when you look at the figure of Mousavi, he is so endearingly uncharismatic. He can't make three sentences together without using the word in Persian, cheese, which means the thing. He just keeps losing words and losing momentum in his speech. No. Iranian Revolution of 1979 was the last grand illusion that happened of the 20th century. Mm. The Egyptian Revolution of the 2011 is the first postmodern revolution that is not predicated on grand illusions.
Explain that.
Meaning that it is through the extension of the public space and creation of social networking. And by social networking, I don't mean just a Facebook. There is a synergy between grassroots social formations from labor unions, women's rights activists, and student activists that extends into internet. And internet acts as a catalyst to recreate the public space.
What about Israel?
Sooner or later, the young generation of Israelis will want to join this bloc party. From Morocco to Bahrain, from Syria to Yemen, there is a bloc party, and they want to join the party. They will tear down these apartheid walls because they don't like to live in ghetto. Their parental generations have lived in ghettos. They have had the horrors of the Holocaust on their back for generations. There is an emancipatory moment from Morocco to Afghanistan, from Turkey down to Yemen, and they want to join the party.
Tahrir Square, in a certain sense, has scooped or taken the play away from the Green Movement in Iran, which didn't, after all, come to power. What is the effect even on Iran today, on the Ahmadinejad and the Mullah's government?
Listen, I was in a program called Empire in Al Jazeera back in July 2009. We were talking about the Green Movement. And at some point in that interview, I say, if this is July 2009, a month after the uprising in Iran, a year and a half before Tahrir Square, in which I say, if I were a person in a position of power and authority anywhere from Morocco to Syria, I will watch what's happening in Iran very, very carefully. Mm. Marwan Beshara, the host, turned to me and laughed and said, you mean Iran is going to export yet another revolution? I said, these kids will. Because the demographic composition of Iran, and Iranians are not the only one who are wired and are on the internet, is exactly identical with the rest of the Arab world and Islamic world, and this will happen in those worlds. People as far as China are thinking of precisely the
same thing. I was just going to ask. I mean,
yeah. Again, there's something in the air. There's something about the nature of the internet, the global village in which we are witnessing. But it is not created by the internet. It is facilitated by the internet.
Hamid Debashi, you wrote in Al Jazeera not long ago, what we are witnessing is a new planetary awakening far beyond Arab or any other ethnic nationalism. The world is giving birth to a new geography of itself. You went on to say, the imaginative geography of this uprising maps out a whole new topography of the world for us to navigate and discover. Be as specific as you can where ordinary folk, ordinary Americans, can see that. Be persuaded of your point, and then, if they choose, take part.
Listen, the presupposition of either American exceptionalism, the whole world was somewhere else, and then it was us, is no longer demographically, economically viable. The civilizational divide between East and the West, or the West and Islam, is no longer viable. There is overwhelming, the circulation of labor and capital around the globe has brought millions of people from around the globe here to United States, and United States is all over the globe in terms of its military bases and so forth. Military bases in Iraq were called Delaware and New Jersey and Pennsylvania, as you know. The globality of our condition is such that no military operation can single-handedly hold it and operate it. There is a fundamental difference between European imperialism and American imperialism.
What is it?
European imperialism works through, again, the metaphor of soccer, what we call soccer here, is territorial gain. American imperialism works through football, American football. You don't need territorial gain. So far as you throw the ball to your wide receiver.
The long bomb, so to speak.
Yeah. So you stay home and you throw the ball all the way to that corner. All you need is one wide receiver, whether it's Israel or Saudi Arabia or Tajikistan or whatever it is. You have a military base there. You don't need territorial control. The British imperialism was territorial control, but it failed. It just didn't. After 1948, they packed their belongings and went back. And some new order is emerging. And it is not that Americans ought to be part of it. Americans are part of it. They have to recognize it. It's a psychological barrier, not a material barrier. Is simply to recognize United States in the world. That's another revelation. It's just a fact of the matter. Just right here in New York, on our own. I mean, I know there are differences between Kalamazoo and New York, but nevertheless, you walk in across the street, you hear 15 languages, and how glorious and how wonderful and how richer we are by virtue of all of these various labor migrations. In 1976, when I came to Philadelphia, every street corner was selling these ghastly hot dogs that was clogging our veins and raising our cholesterol. With the first wave of Korean labor migrations into the United States, every street corner was full of vegetable and fruit. Koreans made Americans added to their lifespan millions of years collectively by making them eat fruits and vegetables instead of those ghastly things. This is so the world is already in the United States. The United States is in the world. And by force of nature, not by and history, by force of history, United States is being released, is being delivered from this false, schizophrenic, fragile republic that we have in our midst, in our heart, and this imperial hubris and arrogance that we flex around the globe.
Walk your garden variety American through a different attitude about us in the world.
We are emerging from a provincialism which was manufactured, ideologically manufactured, and was against the very grain of our own historical experiences by virtue of successive generations of immigrants, Italian Americans,
Irish American, Jewish American, Polish Americans. The world kept coming here. But they were all coming into this delusional ideology that we are exceptional and we are different and this and that. And I'm absolutely convinced that by force of history, we are overcoming that schizophrenic fact of our cultural identity and coming to terms with the cosmopolitan disposition of our own culture here, constantly informed by immigration from, listen, CNN fires Lou Dobbs and asks me to write, columns for them. Can you imagine that?
Go back to Iran. You come to this whole story as a culture critic before politics. Read Iran as a sort of a cultural x-ray or psychiatrist, if you will. What's coming and when?
Because in Iran we have lacked the material condition of a rising democracy. We have been dreaming about democracy, very vivid dreams, in poetry, in fiction, in cinema, in drama. I used to call it phantom liberties, because we lacked it. We began to imagine it very vividly. So beginning in early 20th century, if you look at the map of Iranian cultural productions in poetry, in fiction, in cinema, in drama, in painting, in photography, you have had multiple lenses through which liberty, freedom, emancipation have been dreamt. The same is true throughout the Arab and Muslim world. For every Kiarostami that exists in Iran, you have Yusuf Shaheen in Egypt, you have Mufid Talatli in Tunisia, and you have Ilyas Suleiman in Palestine, and so forth. Nothing happens in Iran which is exclusive to Iran, and you don't have its replicate in other parts of the region. We have been dreaming and imagining and fantasizing about how we wish our life to be in multiple ways. In those cultural manifestations, we have been dreaming it. So when it comes to the streets of Tehran and you see this, the choreographed song and dance of kids pouring into the streets in the course of presidential election, rhythmically singing and dancing their freedom, there is nothing new. They have already seen it in their films and heard it in their poetry and imagined it in their fiction.
Americans in general, and maybe President Obama in particular, looking at a brand new world, don't know quite what to make of it. What should we, what might we be doing?
President Obama has been trapped inside the Beltway. And as I have said, on many occasions, he has to go back to his time as a community activist. He has to think as a community organizer. He has to stop thinking as a chief executive officer trapped inside Washington, D.C. If he, for a minute, began to think about the globe the way he thought about Chicago, we will have an infinitely superior president. I mean, I voted for him. I'm pissed off with him. But again, show me a picture of Sarah Palin, I will vote for him 10 more times. But I'm deeply disappointed in his presidency, because the culture of Washington, D.C., this limited vocabulary of how you can imagine the world is getting the better of him and doesn't let him. I mean, read his books. If you read his books, you see he has the imagination, but Washington, D.C. has robbed him of the courage of his imagination.
Washington has persuaded him, I think, that his job is to be captain of the empire and save it, perhaps, you know, smooth some rough edges, back it off a little bit, but preserve the fundamental idea that that we are the indispensable nation, that American prosperity is somehow the core of the world's well-being, and we have all that military power to make it happen, et cetera.
Yeah.
Can you imagine instructing him how to be himself again?
Of course. to be part of the world, to be integral to the world, not to lead it, abandon or lead it by example, leading it from home, addressing the fundamental issues. Didn't he say that he will be on the picket line if there was a labor unrest, a labor union? Where is he? Is in Wisconsin? Is he in Ohio? The heart of American society right now is in Wisconsin, is in Ohio. He has to be there as a community activist. Because there is a, have you seen the signs in Wisconsin that says we need a Tahrir Square? You don't need to You don't need to go to Egypt for a Tahrir Square. There is a Tahrir Square already in Wisconsin. 35 million Americans underinsured and under poverty line. You don't need a Tahrir Square there is a fundamental ideological manner of concealing that definitive fact to our society.
Mm.
He has to reconnect with it as a community activist. And he then we will join the world by example, not by leadership. This world cannot be led. Forget about it. The leadership of this world was a cockamamie Newcon nonsense that you can lead the world. The world is unmanageable.
Of course, that's the way he won the nomination of the president.
Exactly.
He didn't say, I will lead you. He will say, you will lead yourselves.
Yes. And every day, every single day, he has distanced himself from the Obama that we knew and we voted for.
Hmm. Hamid Debashi, you've written a lot and you speak a lot today about this cosmopolitan impulse in all of us, in Persians, in Americans, in Jews, in Europeans, in a fundamental sense that not only we're connected, but we can't be driven by fear in relations. And yet the reality of so many nations, including our own, tends to be tribal and sectarian and fearful. Who's got a cure or a counter for those narrowing impulses, which we see everywhere?
Is individual and societal. It is a mental block. It is a fear. As soon as push comes to shove, you reach for the most common denominator of sectarian identity. I'm a Jew. I'm a Muslim. I'm a Irish, etc. And all of these reductionism to one thing or another is at the expense of the factual, historical, worldly experiences that you have had, that it is impossible for you or me or for any American to sit down and come with a tally that every experience that we have had, every emotion we have had, every loyalty we have had is reducible to our sectarian identity. Impossible. From our aesthetics to our imagination to our politics to our works of art we admire, we are cosmopolitan in reality, but then we dwindle and degenerate into sectarianism out of fear. It is a psychological condition. It has nothing to do with worldly, material, historical fact of our cosmopolitanism.
You'd have thought, we all thought, that Barack Obama, with a Columbia degree and a Harvard Law degree, was almost a dream model of the
Not almost, exactly. He is the model. He is the model. He is the best expression of our hopes and aspiration. Mm. And he remains that because he embodies everything that is good, everything that is ideal, everything that is forward, progressive, and worldly about this. This is how he was elected. But it's still the fact is that this gridlock, this language, this, I don't know. I mean, we took our kids to Washington, D.C. for Christmas break. Still the fact is the air of Washington is much easier to breathe after Obama and his family are there than the previous 8 years. But something, I mean, I don't, I've become, you know, I have no, I don't know how to explain Washington, D.C. What happens in Washington, D.C. behind those walls? It's a beautiful city. I mean, it has a phony Roman architecture situation, but nevertheless, it's a pretty city. There is a disconnect between our moral imagination and the architecture of our hopes and aspirations when we invested in somebody like Obama, which comes from us in every conceivable way. And then when we deposit them in Washington, D.C., maybe we should change the mode of government and the government should be led from, I don't know, California or New York or something. Just leave Washington, D.C. alone.
What if, as you say, we've outgrown the need for charismatic, single, heroic perfect leaders.
It is not as a charismatic leader that he was elected, in my judgment, but as a manifestation of all hopes and aspirations of young generation of Americans who voted for him. And they come from all over. They are not, I'll confess to you, I voted for him because I wouldn't dare facing my eldest son and daughter telling them that I didn't vote as in previous presidential election. They were adamant and active Obama people and voted for him. And in solidarity with them, I voted for President Obama. And also, I have four children, and two of them are the age that they voted for President Obama. That also changed my conception of what it means to be American.
Really?
In the sense that I thought that some are Americans by virtue of their parents being American, but some are American by virtue of their children being American. There is this emotive and moral and hopeful way of identifying with your country that I thought was coming to the fore only during the presidential election of 2008.
Hamid Debashi, thank you. Thank you for the books I've read, Iran, the Green Movement, and the U.S., Fox and Paradox, and also Iran, A People Interrupted. And thank you for this conversation.
Thank you, Chris. Thanks for the wonderful conversation.
Ben Mandelkern produced and edited this conversation. It isn't over until you feed back on our website, radioopensource.org. I'm Christopher Lydon. Thank you for being part of the conversation.